domestic phone and is now in the possession of the
Army. Really what the heck that could be.
Okay, we'll assume it's friendly anyway, okay?
Two of them, and they're acting
spot
the whole time. They're
out
there, like,
say
that.
Oh, my God, I hope that's a plane. Oh, Jesus, please be a plane. Oh, please. Come on, Lisa. I ain't ready for this.
The cameraman said, what the hell is that midway across the Hudson River? Was it perfectly circular? Yes.
UFO over New York, and I ain't too surprised.
For the first time in our history, we're studying something that's studying us.
Nobody told me that the days like this.
Suddenly, something else flew into the frame. Fired a beam of light, struck the dummy warhead, doing a circle, if you can imagine, circling our warhead. Fired another beam of light at it, which struck the warhead.
The Virtually Strange Network presents Strange Days Indeed, your premier source for UFO information, with your host, Errol Bruce Knapp.
Yes, these are Strange Days Indeed, and this program reflects the UFO side of the strangeness. Welcome to program number 377. Tonight, Dave Frelott and a feature interview with Major Kevin Randall, Ph.D. Major Doctor Kevin Randall, a researcher and investigator and the author of many UFO-related books, including those on Roswell and abductions, and we'll get into some of the titles of those later. As always, it seems now, Victor Vigiani in studio with me. Evening.
Good evening, sir.
We always behave as if we haven't said hello to one another beforehand. Evening.
It's the very first time I've ever seen you in my life.
Yes. Who are you?
Hello. How are you? Nice to meet your acquaintance.
It's good to have you back again. An interesting week this week.
Lots of stuff coming down, sure.
Lots of stuff coming down. Major discussions about... Lieutenant Colonel Philip Corso, the late Colonel Philip Corso.
Lots of discourse on the UFO updates about that.
Yeah.
Some new people and some standards.
Well, yeah, well, Ed Gurman, or Ed German, who's a proponent of the alien abduction film, the alien autopsy film, I should say.
Oh, that.
has been chastising a lot of fairly prominent names in the field on the UFO updates list this week for not reading Philip Corso's Day After Roswell carefully enough to be able to understand Ed Gurman's point.
Well, you read it, or you read it carefully.
Yeah, well, that's it. I mean, it's Dave Frelott and I were talking this afternoon, and I know Dave's going to mention it a little later. As we said, you know, oh, yeah, I read The Day After Roswell, but I read every fifth word.
Well, I've read it six times, you know.
I know. Yeah. It's very... And then, on top of that, Ed Gurman got into supporting the George Adamski story. George Adamski, one of the first contactees. Very, very strange week as far as the list is concerned.
Yeah, the only problem that I have with all that stuff, I guess, Errol, I mean, I don't want to, you know.
Go ahead.
Of course, why not? I mean, that's why we're here, isn't it?
It is, isn't it?
You know, it's such a... You know what I liken it to? I'm sorry. With all the discourse about stuff that's gone on, it's like trying to drive a car with your windshield painted black and using the rear view mirror to drive the car.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way I view that type of discourse. It looks behind. It doesn't... There's no forward-looking, anticipatory... activist type of performance or rhetoric or talk or language in that. It seeks to just bring up things of the past and doesn't advance the cause at all, as far as I'm concerned.
Mm-hmm.
It says nothing about the future.
And I think a lot of the problem is that there are far too many people out there who are interested in this, in UFOs, who have too much time on their hands, and they're much happier sitting at home at their screens and their keyboards.
Splitting hairs.
Splitting hairs rather than, oh, there's something happening. Something happened just 40 miles away. I should go check that out. Go mm-hmm. talk to the witnesses.
That's right. Yeah.
Not enough field work being done anymore.
Actually, that's true. That's true. Yeah. That's one aspect of this.
It's a major aspect.
It's a major, yeah.
You know, it just, after a while, sitting there and handling all of this mail as I do every day, you know, it just starts to pall.
Yeah, I can understand how that would happen. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, how do you thread through it? I mean, these are expressions of people's feelings about a topic that, you know, a large portion of the population that may be listening to this really don't think about at all.
At all.
But on this list, it's an intense form of ongoing bang, bang, bang discourse. Yeah. Everybody has their point of view. And if we could get the other 95% of the population engaging in this type of exchange of information, then maybe we'd move ahead with the whole thing. But right now, it seems to be buried in a hole. And it just, I mean, you can look in the past, you can talk about, you can thread the needle, split the hair, but what do you do from there? What type of activism are you willing to become engaged in order to put this in front of the people who need to know about it, the public in general, the mainstream media, and of course our politicians? I mean, that's where we need to be going with this and not sitting in some hovel banging on a keyboard.
Some hovel. Oh my.
Well, that's what's going on. And yeah. I don't want to, I can't criticize that because that's the level of interaction some people want to take with this.
Yeah.
But you have to raise it to another level to say, what can we do about this? Not can we say, not can we talk about, what can we do about this? And it's not, you know, it's like the adult says, don't do what I say, do what I do, or the other way around.
Don't do what I do what I say. Yeah,
yeah, this is just the opposite of that. We have to do, we have to engage, and we have to become people who present the language of the UFO community to the rest of the general population. And that's what we have to do. And I don't see some of the things going on right now currently of looking in the past, doing anything of that nature at all. It's drumming up old things in the past that we've talked about, they've been dealt with, they're part of the data bank, and great, that's fantastic. But let's move on. Let's make this thing something that helps to change things the way we want to change them.
Yeah, I get the feeling that there aren't any changes going on. I mean, there never have been. For me,
and socially, or within
the UFO community, you know.
Well, it's, I think there are some people who
we just keep on, as we said, we keep on rehashing, and I'm rehashing what we just said.
Yeah. Well, you can't. That's the way it is. As far as I'm concerned, if you've got a
there we go.
Yeah, it's okay. If you got a candle that's burning bright, that's sending a message, you don't hide it under a basket. Mm. You lift the basket and let everybody see the light. And right now. Well,
yeah,
we're suffering from a big basket.
Also, a lot of sighting reports coming out of Manitoba this past week or so.
Yes, that's true. That's true.
Brian Vike at his website HBCC UFO. Brian, who contributes to this program on a fairly regular basis,
he's on top of things. For sure.
Yeah, some interestings coming out of there. Parkland area of Manitoba, two witnesses saw a large orange glowing sphere in the 9:30 in the evening. The problem with those glowing orange spheres is that they tend to be natural,
mm-hmm.
incoming from out there.
Not something of substance in terms
substantial.
Of,
yeah. It's lights in the sky again, you know, which is
yes, yeah,
yeah. And in Manigotigan, Manitoba, which is 100 kilometers north from Pine Falls, for those of you who know the area well, three witnesses. Brother and sister and their dad saw three objects, three balls of light in a perfect triangle. Now, doesn't that sound familiar?
You're darn right.
That's the NOS satellites, isn't it? It's the U.S. Navy satellites
it's threes. That's right.
Yeah, and not in the usual path of satellites. Northeast was what these three people saw.
Mm-hmm.
So if you see three lights in the sky like that, little pinpoints of light, but traveling in a perfect triangle, their U.S. Navy satellites.
Unless they stop and reverse their course and start spinning around, it's probably that same satellite.
They pull a sharp 90-degree turn and speed off into the moonlight.
Which they've been known to do.
Yes, they have. And those are not U.S. Navy satellites that do that.
Here with his take on it is Dave Furlong.
A thread has been ongoing on the UFO updates list for a little while now, and I have purposefully abstained from commenting on it because I believe that eventually it would sink to the lowest common denominator and simply disappear. However, it would seem that some of the proponents of the thread insist on keeping it going. It's called Colonel Corso and His Critics. Obviously, there's a lot of controversy concerning the book The Day After Roswell, written by Lieutenant Colonel Philip Corso and William J. Burns. For those of you that are not familiar with the book, it basically states that almost single-handedly, Lieutenant Colonel Philip Corso was responsible for initiating the development of some of the most advanced technologies on the planet. They include the transistor, night vision, personal computers, super tenacity fabrics including Kevlar, lasers, etc., etc. And how did he do it? Well, he distributed technology that was recovered from the site of the crash of an alien spacecraft in 1947 near Roswell, New Mexico. Hence, the title of the book. Now, ufologists much more notable than I did a lot of digging when Corso's book was published, and they made a number of discoveries that placed the book in the highly unbelievable category. And based on some of the evidence that was presented by Kevin Randall, Stanton Friedman, and others concerning the book, I filed Colonel Corso and his book in the don't bother category, figuring that it would go away. But, like the alien autopsy film, it simply keeps surfacing. The book and Lieutenant Colonel Corso's claims serve as the cornerstone for Dr. Michael Sala's exopolitical theory, and he, along with a few others, defend the validity of the claims made by Corso in The Day After Roswell. Dr. Sala really has no choice but to defend the book and all of its claims, because without it, the whole exopolitics movement would fall down like a house of cards. The reality, however, is that Dr. Sala is defending an indefensible position. I believe my position on the whole exopolitical theory is well known, but for those who are not familiar with it, I will repeat. Anyone who believes in the whole exopolitics theory as presented by Dr. Michael Sala has to believe that the motion picture Men in Black was a documentary and not simply an entertaining piece of fiction. Now, I've done some considerable digging concerning Lieutenant Colonel Corso and have made some interesting discoveries. But before we get into those, I'd like you to think for a moment concerning one of my very favorite theories, and that is that technologically advanced societies simply overcome others. Lieutenant Corso would have us believe that he was given the mission to seed companies in the United States with alien technologies so we could develop similar devices in order to be able to fight the aliens if and when they decided to take over the planet. To put it in perspective for you, it would be like an Aztec warrior giving a steel sword, a breastplate, a helmet, and a musket captured from one of Cortez's soldiers to his people, telling him to go build things like that. Although they might marvel at the devices, without the knowledge of how they were developed and a source of the necessary resources available, there wouldn't be a chance in hell of them developing steel and gunpowder. But I'm going to leave that whole thought for a moment and concentrate on the facts. And here are some of the facts. Colonel Corso claimed in his book that he saw an alien body in 1947, and after that had no contact with anything concerning Roswell until a day in February of 1961 when crates were brought into his office and General Trudeau gave him the mission to distribute the technologies that were inside the crates. That would mean that modern technologies that we have today would have to begin sometime around 1961. And prior to that date, we would not have any knowledge of these advancements. Well, let's take the transistor. On the 22nd of December, 1947, William Shockley, John Bardeen, and Walter Brattain succeeded in building the first practical point-contact transistor at Bell Labs. That's a few years earlier than 1961. Night vision. In 1953, John Crane Buell took Robert Wiseman, who was the head of the U.S. Army's night vision lab for 27 years, to an Illuminating Engineering Society meeting in Chicago. There, Wiseman met Oscar Cleaver, an electrical engineer from Fort Belvoir, who wanted to start a program in night vision and was looking for someone to direct it. Once again, a few years earlier than 1961. Personal computers, and this is one of my favorites because I was directly involved with it on the PC side with IBM. However, the first solid-state transistor computer was TRADC, which is an acronym for Transistor Digital Computer, and it was put to work in 1954. Alas, once again, somewhat earlier than 1961. The laser. The invention of the laser, which stands for light amplification by stimulated emission of radiation, can be dated to 1958, with the publication of the scientific paper Infrared and Optical Masers by Arthur L. Shaulow, then a Bell Labs researcher, and Charles E. Townes, a consultant to Bell Labs. Once again, earlier than 1961. Obviously, I could go on, but I believe I've made my point here. Lieutenant Corso did many great things during the course of his military career, most notably dealing with POWs of the Korean War. But in researching the man and his accomplishments, I have also discovered that his civilian job was as a motion picture projectionist, and one of his acclaimed hobbies was building radios, which would give him a little knowledge when it came to understanding advanced technologies, and possibly a means to substantiate his claims. I do not know for certain that Lieutenant Colonel Corso had no involvement with an event that happened in Roswell, New Mexico in 1947, but I will say that his claims of seeding U.S. companies with alien technology appear to be bogus. But that's just my take on it.
Dave Furlong, every week at this time. Strange days, indeed.
Yeah, well, 1961 was an interesting year in many ways, it would seem, Dave.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it certainly was.
Mm.
But it had nothing to do with the beginning of any of those technologies, that's for sure.
So you're just throwing the baby out with the bathwater then?
Not throwing the baby out with the bathwater. I'm basically taking the position and the substantiation or the question has always been, okay, somebody proved that he was lying. You know, you got to prove that he was lying, otherwise we have to believe him. Well, no, don't necessarily have to prove that he was lying. Basically have to take a look at what he says.
And there we have to leave it, Dave.
Okay.
We'll leave it until next week. Good night, Dave. Thank you. This man who is on the phone awaiting his introduction down there in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. What a multifaceted man Kevin Randall is.
Amazing amount of things he's been into.
Yeah.
Just amazing.
He has written all kinds of science fiction books. He was one of the major investigators of the Roswell case, has written several books on that, books on abduction. I mean, you name it, and Kevin Randall has done it, and especially of late. Kevin Randall is a major in the United States Army Reserve. Did a stint in Iraq, or as they like to say, south of the border, Iraq, which I find highly irritating, but, you know, that's a whole other thing. Kevin Randall, welcome back to the program.
Well, thank you very much.
Yay! I'm glad that you're home and that things went relatively well for you. How long were you in Iraq?
I was there 11 months. Just over 11 months, counting the time we were in Kuwait. And I should point out to you, I'm not really in the Army Reserve. I'm in the National Guard.
Oh, in the National Guard.
And all my National Guard friends would beat me about the head and shoulders if I didn't correct that.
Okay, fair enough. You know, I'm just a dumb Canuck or Canuck.
and we call it Iraq.
Iraq. Why don't they call it Italy then, I wonder?
I have no idea.
It's very strange. Iraq and Iran. Yeah, well, that's a whole fettle of another kish. doing the kind of work that you did in Iraq or Iraq, any interesting reports of things in the sky other than what one would expect to see in the sky there?
No, nothing that would really fit into the show, other than to say that some of the skills that I had learned investigating UFOs came into play while I was investigating some other things, the launching of surface-to-air missiles specifically, before it became well known that those were in the hands of the terrorists, that some of my skills in investigating and interviewing people helped help establish that that really was going on.
Mm. So you were actually out in the field, or should I say out in the sand, in the desert, a fair bit of time.
I got out into the field a number of times, yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
We were at the scene of the UN bombing, for example, within hours of that happening. And because I'm a military officer, I had free rein to walk all over the whole place and was able to talk to any number of people. And since I was an officer and most of them were enlisted men, they pretty much answered my questions.
Mm. Yeah. There's some fairly ugly things have gone on in that country. And I don't know, perhaps with a great deal of luck and a reasonable amount of judgment, things will turn out well there.
I think that knowing what I know and having seen what I have seen, I think that we can expect things to go better for us. A lot of the things that I think the United States would like to see happen there is happening with the elections and many of the Iraqis stepping up to volunteer for the security forces, whether it's Army or their National Guard or their police force, especially when there's a horrendous terrorist bombing. There is a real rush by Iraqis to join the security forces to try to put down some of the violence and that thing. And I think that's a very positive thing that doesn't get enough play in the media.
It seems to me that, they call them insurgents.
I call them terrorists.
Well, okay, but the word insurgent means, you know, that you're basically coming in from the outside, and it seems that a lot of the terrorism that's being carried out is being done by non-Iraqis.
Yes, and that again doesn't get enough play, I think, to let them know that most of the Iraqi population supports the United States and what we were doing. I mean, in all the time I was in convoys traveling through Baghdad to create all over Iraq, only one time did anybody yell something at us nasty, and I just smiled and waved. And most of the time they wanted to come up and shake our hands and thank us for getting rid of Saddam Hussein, which I thought was interesting.
Well, you mentioned that you staged in Kuwait, so presumably you were part of that whole ride across the desert, huh?
We motored north from Kuwait to Baghdad, yes.
Mm.
And we got to sleep outside beside our vehicles and all of that kind of interesting stuff.
All that neat military stuff, yeah, I remember that.
Yes, all that stuff you see about in the movies. Read about in the books. We did some of that for real.
Yes.
And I told our soldiers before we did that, I said, my biggest concern is how hot am I going to get, how tired am I going to get, and how sore is my butt going to get riding in this Humvee hour after hour after hour. That was my concerns.
And how sore did your butt get riding in the Humvee?
I actually was smart enough to bring a pillow. So the Humvee is not made for comfort.
Uh-huh.
And I think when they first started bringing them in the Army, they were like $25,000 a copy. And I said, for that kind of money, they better have one hell of a stereo in it. And, of course, it didn't.
No.
The radio we had was basically for two-way communications and not for listening to tunes.
Mm-hmm. Now, you worked in radio on air. Did you do any of that while you were there? Because I believe there is an Armed Forces radio station there, huh?
There is, and we just never listened to it very much. I had nothing to do with that at all. What I did was newspaper articles for our local news, our hometown newspapers here in the state of Iowa, and we had units from other states that joined us to fill out our mission, and I provided newspaper articles to their home stations as well. So mainly my communication back home was with through the typewriter or the computer as opposed to on-air communications.
Mm. I want to come back to what this program is about.
Good idea.
No, but we had to touch on some of the things that you did. The other thing that we didn't touch on was your trip to a palace there. What was it, the palace of Nebuchadnezzar?
We had the opportunity, limited though it was, our chaplain had an opportunity to accompany another chaplain down to Babylon. And that was one of the things I wanted to do, kind of a touristy thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And in our battalion, there were only maybe a half a dozen of us who had the opportunity to do this, and I availed myself of that opportunity. So we got to explore the city of Babylon for an afternoon while we were there. And my picture, and it's actually on my blog, of me sitting in the throne room on the place where the throne would have been, a big platform out there, sitting there in, I guess it's Nebuchadnezzar's palace in Babylon. So that was interesting to see those ruins and see what had been done by, and a lot of the restoration had been done by Saddam Hussein. And back in when it was first built, the names of the kings were impressed in some of the bricks as they built the thing, so you'd see them. And as Saddam Hussein had it restored, well, he had his name impressed in some of the bricks in the reconstruction. So you could see bricks with his name on it. I've actually got a close-up picture of one of those bricks with me pointing to it, which is Saddam Hussein's name in this massive thing of Babylon.
Mm.
Where they say the Hanging Gardens really weren't. They actually were probably north in Mosul.
Oh. So forget the Babylon trip, huh?
No, the Babylon trip was fascinating, but the Hanging Gardens are long gone. And if you ask any of the guides there where were the Hanging Gardens, they all have a different answer. And some of them will tell you, we're not even sure they were here.
Mm.
But getting back to the topic of the program, there, of course, were those batteries found.
Yes.
In Babylon. And so I didn't get a chance to see any of those, but I asked about them, and they were taken to a museum in Baghdad.
Oh, so they managed to those ancient batteries that they figure are thousands of years old.
Two or 3,000, yeah.
Yeah, didn't get looted when Baghdad fell.
There's no gold in them. There was no intrinsic value in them.
Right.
So no, those things were in the museums in Baghdad. And a lot of the material, and that's something else the media hasn't played up, but a lot of the stuff that was looted from the museums has actually been found and returned to the museums.
Oh, good.
So I mean, it was a real mistake, I think, on the part of our forces, and nobody really thought in terms of looting the museums, that somebody would do that. So there were no... In the operations orders, there were no contingencies for dealing with the protection of those documents and stuff.
Kevin Randall, Major Kevin Randall, PhD, Major Doctor, Dr. Major. He's with the National Guard down there in the United States. You may recognize his name from the several books that he's written on Roswell and various other ufologically oriented subjects. Did you know, Kevin, that there are 17 of your books listed at Amazon.com?
It fluctuates up and down.
Yeah.
I look at it periodically just as kind of ego boo.
Yeah, well...
I'm not doing as good as Webb Griffin and some of the big name writers, but
hey, you know, they're not going to Iraq and being a major in the National Guard. You're a man of many talents. While you were away, not a great deal has happened in ufology. Some interesting theories, a couple of interesting books, in particular Nick Redfern's book on body snatchers in the desert,
Flock likes to call it BS in the desert.
Who likes to call it?
Carl Flock.
Oh, Carl Flock, yeah.
BS in the desert.
Do you agree with that?
With Carl Flock on that?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
I don't think there's very good evidence that some kind of horrific experiment involving deformed Japanese and Horton Brothers flying wings and Japanese balloon bombs were conducted in New Mexico in 1947.
Knowing that Nick Redfern has done some pretty good work in the past, and I don't believe for a moment that he's made up his witnesses or invented his witnesses or his contacts, what would you think would be the reason for those people telling Nick Redfern the stories that you've just mentioned?
I think you have people telling Nick Redfern tales, not unlike any number of other witnesses at Roswell we can point to who were telling tales. And the name that springs immediately to mind is Frank Kaufman, who for almost a decade was telling us tales of his involvement in the retrieval operation at Roswell, that he spent a great deal of time on the inside helping manipulate the media so that they wouldn't get to the story. And once Frank Kaufman died, and researchers had an opportunity to look at some of his files, they discovered the documentation that suggested that Frank Kaufman was lying to us. And what would be the point? Well, Frank Kaufman got to be on lots of TV shows, which he never would have been on had he not been carrying these tales. He did make some money on the deal, and one of the reasons the researchers, and I believe it was Mark Rodiker, Don Schmidt, Mark Chesney, among others who were there, his wife, Juanita, had asked them to take a look at his files to make sure that that all contractual obligations had been fulfilled. And in the process of exploring those records, at the insistence of Kaufman's wife, his widow, they discovered the documentation that proved that Kaufman was inventing everything that went on around him. And the point is people probably told Nick Redfern these tales, but they're probably not true. And I can point to any number of things. If you go back to the era of the Vietnam War in this country and you look at the oral histories and the memoirs that came out in the 70s and 80s, you'll find that an awful lot of those stories were told by men who did not serve in combat in Vietnam, did not serve in Vietnam, did not serve in the military. They're inventing the tales for whatever reason, to make themselves feel better about themselves, to put themselves into the spotlight. But there's an awful lot of evidence that the more horrific the tale, the more likely is it is that it was invented by the teller.
Yeah. By that, Kevin, would you mean, let's take, for example, just about any major issue that's come up within ufology within the past 35 to 40 years, and let's look at the MJ-12 documents, for example. That can be considered, at one level, a very tall tale, but by others within the research community, it appears to be put forward as truth. How do we continue to reconcile these grossly polemic argument just about anything that comes up about ufology? How do we make sense of where the truth lies?
Well, using the MJ-12 documents as an example, we have no provenance for the documents. Where did they come from? We cannot go to the National Archives. We cannot go to any of the presidential libraries. We can't go to an independent source and verify the authenticity of those documents. What we have in MJ-12 are photographs of what are allegedly copies of those documents. We do not have the original document. So where we can take a look forensically at the type styles, and we can look to see if the typewriters, the fonts matched typewriters from that era, and things like that, we do not have the original documents. And I think what we need to do as ufologists is take a step back from, yes, I would really like to believe MJ-12 is authentic, and say in a dispassionate scientific voice, wait a minute, we cannot prove these things authentic. We have some interesting things to suggest they may be authentic, and on the other side of the coin, there are some things that suggest they are obvious forgeries. So we need to look at it from the point of view at this moment. Nothing about MJ-12 is really proved. It is all up in the air, and until we can get to the point where we find the provenance for those documents, we're always going to be in that position.
I guess the only question that I would have is, then if all of these so-called documents in quotation marks exist, and the number of pages that are dedicated to the information that's there, listing people's names, incidents, protocols, procedures, and so on, there must have been some individual who was very, very creative, or a group of people who were extremely in the know and creative, that would sit down and actually put pen to paper or keyboard to whatever, or type out this stuff and get it and pump it out to someone to proffer it out there to the UFO community to be in the form of disinformation. That seems to me to be the only other fallback default position that we could ascribe to these documents. How do you react to that?
First of all, the original documents are the ones that were on photographs, the Eisenhower briefing document, the Truman memo. So there's a limited number of documents there. Second of all, the people that appear on those documents specifically are all dead, so they cannot confirm or deny what's happened there. When we move to the thousands of pages of other documents that have been put out, we know, for example, the Aquarius Telex, which was one of the first of the MJ-12 documents and alluded to document MJ-12. This was a message, supposedly an Air Force message, that talked about the MJ-12 meeting in there as evidence. That we know was retyped by Bill Moore, because he said he retyped it because the original document was in such poor quality, the copy he had, that he retyped it and added the headings to make it look like what it really was. But he's admitted to retyping that. So there's a document that's clearly a hoax. We look at a lot of the other documents. They are updated memos from World War II, for example, that insert key MJ-12 stuff into it. And the parent documents, the source documents, have been identified. So a lot of the documents we can look at and say, well, these are faked. When we look at some of the things, the Eisenhower briefing, the manual that was supposedly put out, we have a limited number of pages for those. And the stuff that would be really hard to fake, the autopsy or dissection materials, the photographs from there, the protocols used, those we do not have. We have very generic things that sound good, look good, but aren't necessarily true. So we do not have the original documents. And until we can get our hands on some original documents, not photocopies, not photographs of the documents, but the original documents, so that we can verify, for example, we could test the ink to make sure it was old enough. We could test the paper to make sure it was old enough. There are things that we could do if we had those original documents, and we do not. And I think that is the problem that Dan Rather had when he had the documents about President Bush's service or lack of service in the Air National Guard during the Vietnam War. The argument about the authenticity of documents could have been ended if Dan Rather and CBS could say, yes, here are the originals. We put out the copies so you people could have them, but here are the originals, and we've examined the originals, and they didn't have the originals, and the story collapsed at that point. And that's where we are on MJ-12. We do not have the originals. We do not have the originals of any documents at all. We have copies of them.
The MJ documents, MJ-12 documents, purportedly were put out by a group that was put together by President Truman, of military officers and various high-ranking people around President Truman to deal with the flying saucer situation for those.
Actually, specifically with the crash at Roswell.
With the crash at Roswell, exactly. For those people who aren't familiar with MJ-12 and the supposed MJ-12.
So would you put it, Kevin, that the creation of these documents, in whichever way they were created, be it photographs or retypings by other individuals, is just simply a creation of a myth?
Frankly, yes. We know, for example, and Stan Friedman's told me this, that Bill Moore had said back in the early 1980s he was thinking of creating a Roswell-type document because he'd taken the investigation as far as he could. He wanted to create this document to see what he could shake out for it. He, Bill Moore, Bob Pratt, and Doty, and Doty's first name escapes me.
Richard
Doty,
mm-hmm.
Had written a novel in which MJ-12 first appears, and that novel was written prior to the release of the MJ-12 documents. So I think that we have some very good evidence suggesting that MJ-12 is a hoax. There are also a limited number of expert document examiners, people who are trained in document examination, who don't care one way or another. They're just looking at the authenticity of the documents, and those people have said that MJ-12 is a hoax, and they pointed out the reasons for it. So what we have is a group of documents, and I'm willing to step back and say, okay, let's take this as far as we can, but let's get the original documents before we expend any more time on it. Because without the original documents, we're not going to be able to prove anything, no matter how good the documents are, no matter what sort of evidence we can find in those copies. We're still not going to be able to prove it until we can get the original documents, and those we simply do not have.
So you're putting the Eisenhower briefing documents in that category, too?
Absolutely.
I see.
Absolutely. The Eisenhower briefing documents, the Truman memo, all that original MJ-12 material that came out in the early 80s. Yes, absolutely, because we do not have the original documents. And we have to remember that the onus for proof is on those with the documents claiming the authenticity. They have not been able to prove it. And if we take a look at the work that Bill Moore has done on reviewing the Eisenhower briefing documents and some of those things, he himself has said they're probably fake.
Mm-hmm. So do you think there is any evidence that exists that proves that there might be something like the Majestic 12 documents, or that, in fact, the Majestic 12 documents exist at all?
My opinion is that if there was a crash at Roswell, clearly the government, the civilian end of it, the military end of it, would have created a committee, a panel, somebody to look at this material and see if we could exploit it. If the crash at Roswell is real and we can figure it out, then we, of course, take a leap over our competitors in the world. At the time, that would have been the Soviet Union, if we can figure it out. So, yeah, there would have been a committee. General Exon, who was an Air Force officer who was at Wright Field in 1947 as a lieutenant colonel and later became the base commander at Wright Field as a brigadier general, told me that there was a committee. He didn't know the name of it, which could be MJ-12. He called them the Unholy 13 and gave me the names he believed were on that committee. Some of them matched MJ-12, some of them didn't. And the ones that didn't match were interesting. For example, Stuart Symington, who was the Undersecretary of Defense for Air, I think, in 1947, Undersecretary of the Army for Air or something like that, who was somebody that you figure would have been in this chain of command going up, given who he was in that time, is curiously absent from the MJ-12 documents. And he's a very obscure official, but he would have been involved in some fashion. So Exxon pointed me at Stuart Symington, and that made some sense to me. So the problem is, if Roswell was real and an alien, then, yeah, there would have been a committee. The question is, was it MJ-12? We have no documentation to prove it. We have limited testimony. Was there some committee? Yes, we have testimony alluding to that committee, but not enough to verify either MJ-12 or the name of another committee.
Hmm. No, yeah.
I flummoxed you.
Yeah. Well, yes.
Which is not a good thing on the radio.
Well, no, that's okay. People who listen to this program regularly are used to that.
It's nice listening to the guest.
If in fact Roswell, there was a crash at Roswell, one would assume that there would be a group of people who would be put together as a committee, much like Majestic 12, the 12 members supposedly of that group, the Magic Group. Is there any evidence anywhere at all, Kevin Randall, that such a group was put together?
There is very limited documentation in the Blue Book files suggesting it. Ed Ruppelt suggested briefly in his book about a committee or a group of senior officers at the Pentagon that were very concerned about UFOs in the summer of 1947. There are hints of that sort of thing, but there's really nothing that nails down anything specific like MJ-12.
Hmm.
Yeah, if Roswell was alien, clearly there would have been something created to exploit that information. That's a given. But we have not found any real documentation. We have limited eyewitness testimony, again, using General Exxon as an example, to suggest that there's something to this. But we just really have nothing that we can sink our teeth into and say, yeah, here is the smoking gun proving it beyond a shadow of a doubt.
There are a lot of stories in the UFO world that start out as hot stuff. Somebody takes a very hefty machine gun to them, blows all kinds of holes in them, and the dust settles around, and there's a general acceptance that, yeah, it was a hoax. And then suddenly, out of the blue, it all starts up again. And this seems to be an endless cycle in the field, at least to me, from where I sit at my screen as the moderator of UFO Updates. Do you see that going on as well, Kevin?
Funny you should mention that, because Russ Estes and I talked about that quite a bit, how that the UFO phenomena was cyclic, and that when the interest level peaked again or began again, people who were not familiar with it from before now began to do some research and look into what was going on, and came up, stumbled across these things that we thought we had driven the stake through, proving them to be a hoax, and hadn't gotten to the end of all the research, so that we were obligated to go through it again and again and again. And it doesn't matter whether it's something as ridiculous as the contactees, such as George Adamski and George Van Tassel claiming their trips to Mars and trips to Venus and around the solar system and other places, to the Bermuda Triangle, to some of the well-known hoaxes that we run into. The flip side of that, however, is there's a skeptical community out there that is as rabid in its skepticism as some of the true believers are in their beliefs. And the smallest flaw in a case, they will take and build and say, well, we've proven that to be a hoax, even though that evidence may not be there.
Mm.
And I think specifically of the Trent photos from McMinnville, Oregon in 1950s of the disc over their barn or their garage. And Philip Klass had determined or decided that the case really took place in the evening rather than the morning, as the Trent said. And that proved that the pictures were taken in a different order, and that proved them to be a hoax. And yet Phil Klass and the skeptics were able to offer no evidence that such was the case. It was just their way of explaining it. So there are cases out there where there are people who believe them to be a hoax, and the evidence for hoax really isn't very good. So we're caught in this dilemma of a lot of nonsensical stuff reappearing that we have to drive the stake through, and some very good stuff that is claimed to be hoaxes when it is in fact not.
The history of all of this stuff, Kevin, is something that's really important to me. And I'd like to get your perspective on something. The kinds of things that are involved with trying to see through what comes at us on a daily basis, you know, be it Roswell or MJ-12 documents or abductions or cattle mutilations or all the different kinds of books that are written. When you distill everything right down, where, in fact, does the truth lie? And as someone who's been involved in this field for so long, and you've got a tremendous perspective on it, where do you see the residuals of truth, if there is any? Where do you see the granules of truth lying in this whole issue?
When we look at the Roswell case, I think we see the beginning of the cover-up. If we take a look at the phenomenon as it existed in late June of 1947, when Kenneth Arnold made his sighting, and we look at the newspaper coverage for that period, we see an awful lot of stories about how the government doesn't know what it is. It's not ours, meaning not an American invention. It's not the Soviets. It's not some kind of experimentation. It's not a natural phenomenon. There's all kinds of speculation in the newspaper about what this stuff is. And then on July 8th, you get the story from Roswell that they'd captured a flying saucer, the Walter Haught story. And for 3 hours, that story's out over the wire. And some of the newspapers print how the UFO, the flying saucer, had been captured at Roswell. Within hours, General Ramey says, no, it's a weather balloon, and that became the coverage at that point. But what was more significant is the next day, and there's I've gotten copies of this story from any number of newspapers. It was an Associated Press story that says, the Army and Navy moved today to suppress stories of flying saucers whizzing through our atmosphere. Why suddenly on July 9th did they care about these stories when in the 2 weeks previous to that, nobody cared about it, and there was all the speculation? And I think the answer there is because now they've got one. And suddenly they don't want that speculation. They don't want people talking about it. They want to be able to look at this thing quietly behind the screen so they can figure out what it is. And I think if we look at things like that, then we begin to see these granules of truth. That, yeah, there is extraterrestrial visitation, but it's not nearly as frequent as the UFO sightings would suggest it is. And there seems to be the idea that the sightings back in 47 and 52 and in the early days of ufology are much more complex, are much more exciting than most of the sightings we get today. Because today we get the objects in the sky and the lights in the sky, or we divert off into the abduction phenomena, which may or may not have an extraterrestrial answer to it. So we have a look at as if originally in 1947 in the early years we had lots of good stuff, like they were visiting and gathering all their material, and now they've gone home. And so the sightings that we get today aren't nearly as complex, aren't nearly as meaty as the sightings that we got early on.
There seem to be a lot of stories, a lot of reports of objects making water disappear. I don't know if you're aware of the one that just came out of Argentina a couple of weeks back, where a guy had a big reservoir, a concrete open-topped reservoir for watering his cattle on the Pampas, and there was all the water in the reservoir disappeared. And that happened twice within a couple of days of one another, in very, very close proximity, if indeed it wasn't the same place twice that got hit. And then there was another story that I remember when we first went on the air with this program out of Japan, where they had a fish farm inland with substantial amounts of water in interconnected tanks, all carefully monitored by computer. And the alarms started to go off because the water level was dropping, and the technician rushed outside in time to see an object, a flying disc hanging over the fish farm, drawing up water out of this series of tanks. Those, to me, are interesting stories, and every bit as fascinating as the possibility of a crash in Roswell, and those stories don't, you know, they're not old, they're recent, and those kinds of stories don't seem to go away. Granted, they don't come up quite as often as they seem to have done in the past, but they're still happening.
And if we take a look at the history of ufology, I remember a story that appeared in the April Bulletin, the Aerial Phenomena Research Organization, quite a number of years ago of a dome disc sitting on a hillside with, like, tubes coming out of the top down into a river, sucking the water out of a river. Mm-hmm. And there's stories of UFOs being seen very, very close to high tension lines, suggesting that they may be siphoning off some electricity.
Yeah.
Bill Class used that to create his preposterous ionization of the atmosphere theory back in the 1960s. But there are those very interesting stories. There were the electromagnetic effects that we heard a lot about of in the early days as into the 60s. And again, I think of Levelland, Texas, where you had witnesses at 13 separate locations see the UFO and have it interact with the environment by suppressing their car engines or turning off the lights of their cars and that sort of thing. So there are a lot of those very interesting stories, but we do not see them in the numbers that we used to.
Hmm. Yes. Well, that's, you know, sitting where I sit at my computer on a daily basis, it seems to me that there are interesting stories almost every week. And unfortunately, the follow-ups on those interesting stories are not what they might be, you know, to have them confirmed one way or the other. Occasionally they'll be confirmed as a hoax, but a lot of the time you just don't hear any more about them.
And that's a problem with ufology from the very beginning, that there would be very interesting stories and you try to find a follow-up and they don't exist. Sometimes you'll have a researcher, and Stan Gordon comes to mind immediately,
mm-hmm.
who was interested in the Kecksburg UFO crash from the time it happened and stayed on that story. And had it not been for his tenacious nature, we probably would not discuss Kecksburg at all. Shag Harbor comes to mind with Don Ledger and Chris Stiles.
Yes.
Who stuck on that thing, and if it was not for their follow-up and their research, we wouldn't be discussing that at all. So there are some very good cases. Roswell is in the same boat. If you go back and there was a survey of the 1947 cases put together in the 1970s, and the Roswell case was dismissed in three paragraphs because, well, here was an alleged crash, and the government said it was a weather balloon, let's go on to the next case. And it wasn't until Jesse Marcel came out and said he'd picked up pieces that we actually got on to the Roswell case. So it takes some sort of ignition to get us to do the research, or a researcher who happens to be in the area and is fascinated with the case that is able to do the follow-up and devote the time to the follow-up. Otherwise, it just sort of withers on the vine. I found any number of interesting cases in Iowa or around the country. The Las Vegas UFO crash, there was initial interest in it back in 1962 when it took place, and suddenly, after the initial bump, nothing was said about it. And I happened to see something about it in one of Frank Edwards' books, and I thought, since my mother lived in the area, next time I was out in Vegas, I would go to the files and the newspaper files and see what I could find, and that led to the Air Force files and all kinds of interesting things that came out of that case. But had I not seen that book and had my mother not been living in Las Vegas, I wouldn't have followed that as far as I did.
Mm. Kevin, anything that's really, really irritated you since you've come back to the field, as it were?
It's not a major irritation, but I think the emphasis is being placed on exopolitics is probably a detriment to the field, simply because it's my belief, based on my research, that a number of the key witnesses, the information used to create this exopolitic phenomenon, are probably not who they claim to be. Looking at the backgrounds, looking at the information, that there are some real problems with that information. And I think for ufology to move forward, what we have to do is raise our standards of research, get away from this idea of, I believe this guy because it's what I want to hear, but what is the evidence to suggest that this is true? And I think in ufology, for too long, we kind of followed this idea that the government cover-up, the government desire to keep this information hidden provided an excuse for this information not being readily available. And as we get better at what we do as researchers, we find things that are very troubling about some of these people. And one of the best examples, again, is Frank Kaufman, who came forward with a very good story about Roswell and provided limited documentation suggesting what he said was true. And when we got to the bottom of it, we found out it wasn't true. But there are people still out there, even though we know Frank Kaufman was making it up, that say, well, maybe he was a disinformation agent, so he had some inside knowledge, but he was out there to lead us down the wrong path. And we've got to get away from that sort of thought and into this idea that sometimes people just lie to us. Sometimes people make stuff up. Sometimes they misidentify what they've seen in the sky.
Mm.
And And sometimes they just flat make mistakes, and we've got to expand and improve our levels of research and our investigative capabilities so that we can eliminate that stuff and we can concentrate on what really is important to understanding the phenomenon.
Well, I guess that's one of the reasons that I sort of disagree with you. We're arguing the same point here, but it's a matter of looking at whether the glass is half full or half empty. And granted, there may have been situations, just like there are hoax sightings or misinterpretations or misunderstandings or embellishments of sightings and whatnot, all the way through ufology, you get to see all of that. You get to see the patterns of mistruth or disinformation. What happens when you see a solid line of thinking or a solid line of evidence that you need to pursue and make people aware of it? And one piece of information, as far as I'm concerned, is virtually unassailable, is the witness testimony of Robert Jacobs, a person who saw what happened not only on film, but he also saw it happen in the office of one of his commanding officers and commandeering the film that they did take with them. That whole scenario, what do you do with information like that that appears to be unassailable, and where do you go with it, and what do you do with that kind of information?
Oftentimes there's ways to corroborate that sort of thing and bring it to the forefront. And we can take a look at the history of ufology, and I think we are kind of arguing the same point here, that we can see that things were done to maybe not suppress the information consciously, but certainly divert the research. And you take a look at the Condon Committee, and you see that Ed Condon's idea was there's nothing to this UFO nonsense. And that was the attitude he went into the research with, which is not necessarily the best way to go into research. And you see evidence of his communications with the Air Force communications with him, and in internal communications of his committee suggesting that this is what they're going to do. They've got to get the Air Force off the spot that the Air Force finds itself on, that if they don't end the Project Blue Book in 1969, at the end of the Condon investigation, they're not going to have an opportunity to do it again for another 10 years, and it's going to cost the Air Force hundreds of thousands of dollars. So there are things out there that suggest there's been sort of a cover-up, and some of it may have been a cover-up by default just because they didn't know any better, and some of it was a conscious effort to suppress the information. And it's not to say that the guys in the Air Force who went in or tried to get the Air Force and the university to investigate UFOs was doing it because they believed that was the best way to cover it up. They just thought the Air Force was wasting money. So their motives may have been good, but the results were bad. So there are stories like that are very, very good. But there are other stories told by some people whose credentials do not match up with what they claim to be. That they said, well, I've done this, and when you take a look at it, you find out they haven't done this. Or they claim educational degrees that when you take a look at the institutions, say, we've never heard of this guy. And when you run into that sort of thing, rather than making excuses for them, well, the government was able to get a hold of their records and erase their records, we've got to take a step back and say, maybe this guy is making it up, and go to the next witness and stop wasting time trying to reinvent the wheel by getting information for those guys and providing them with excuses for why reality doesn't seem to match what they claim.
Yeah, it must be a massive frustration for the old-time researchers when you get newcomers to the field who come in and pick up on the stories that were told by people who've been discredited by the old-timers in the field. And so another cycle begins where the old-timers and the people who've been around for a while are looking at what's going on with the relative newcomers and the witnesses who've been discredited, scratching their heads and going, well, what the hell do we do now? You know, and these people, the people who've been discredited, are being put forward as potential witnesses at things like Senate hearings.
And that's the thing that, that really is damaging the field, that the witnesses are not properly vetted.
Mm-hmm.
And all you have to do is vet the witness to make sure that they're who they claim to be. And a lot of times the records are public so that you can get that information or you can verify that information. And if you can't verify it, then go to the next witness. There was a guy that is on one of the witness lists for Stephen Greer's Disclosure Project who said that he was an Air Force lieutenant colonel, and in the process of his classified job, he saw a document relating to a UFO crash at Spitsbergen, and the document was highly classified, and it crossed his desk. I have no doubt that lieutenant colonel was telling the truth, but we who have been around the field are aware of the Spitsbergen documents, and if you go to the Project Blue Book files, you find documents formally classified about that case. We know that that case is a hoax, and yet now we're running into it again and is being revitalized, and the people who are revitalizing it are not aware that under the original case, they talked about having found the disc, but it had Russian instrumentation. So that fact is always left out now, and so it becomes very hard for us to explain this case is done. That colonel is telling you the truth. He saw this classified document, but the document is irrelevant to what we need to do.
Yes. And you know what, Kevin Randall? Our time is up.
I saw that on the clock, and that's why I wound down.
And you did it very well, too, with exactly a minute to go, and Victor and I both appreciate that you're such a radio pro.
Well, thank you.
And it's good talking with you again. And look forward to the next time. I have a feeling it won't be for a little while, though.
It may not be.
Kevin, thank you, sir.
Thank you.
It's always good talking with you. And, boy, it brought in some interesting email, too. None of which I've been told I can read on air. So, we'll talk in the next couple of days, Kevin. And I'll see if I can point you to a place where that audio file that we were talking about is.
Okay.
Now, 27 people are out there scratching their heads saying, what's he saying? Good night, Kevin Randall, and good luck with the next stint.
Thank you.
Good night. Victor Vigiani, thank you, sir.
You're most welcome.
Thank you, Jim Pacheco, Big Daddy Badesage. We shall be back next Saturday night. And in the meantime, your eyes to the skies, please.
That's this week's edition of Strange Days Indeed, hosted and produced by Errol Bruce Knapp, the executive...